This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news now, read by David Cornett.
David Cameron has expressed full confidence in the Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, after Labour called for Downing Street to investigate his relationship with a friend, Adam Werrity. It's emerged that Mr. Werrity was given regular access to the Ministry of Defence and organised a meeting between the minister and businessmen in Dubai. In the past hour, Dr. Fox, who's visiting Libya, has refused to answer questions about Mr. Werrity. In Libya, forces of the Libyan interim government have renewed their offensive in the centre of Colonel Gaddafi's hometown, Sirte. Commanders say they're mounting fresh tank and artillery attacks on areas still held by Gaddafi loyalists. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy is meeting the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, to discuss the Eurozone debt crisis. It's part of a flurry of activity which will see Mr. Sarkozy head to Berlin tomorrow for talks with Chancellor Merkel on how to shore up banks which have been overexposed to sovereign debt. The International Red Cross in Somalia has delivered food aid for the first time to the southern port of Kismayu, which is under the control of the militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab. A convoy of 15 lorries has reached the city. It's part of an operation to distribute food aid to more than 1 million people who are affected by famine in the south of the country. A woman has died in hospital after her electric wheelchair slipped off a harbour wall at Lyme Regis in Dorset. The 20-year-old from the West Midlands had been on holiday with her family. A war memorial in a village in Gloucestershire has been destroyed by vandals. The Cotswold Stone Memorial was smashed to pieces last night in Prestbury near Cheltenham. England have been knocked out of the Rugby World Cup following a 19-12 defeat to France in Auckland. The French will play Wales in the semi-finals after they beat Ireland 22-10. And the weather, it'll be a cloudy and cool afternoon for much of the UK. Rain will spread from the west, turning heavy across northern and western hills, but it will stay dry in southern and southeastern England. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. We're now on Radio 3, today's edition of the Early Music Show, which finds Catherine Bott in the Scottish capital.
Hello from Edinburgh, where I'm just about to enter the University Library and head for an exhibition that's right up the Early Music Show street. It's called Singing the Reformation, and it's heralded as a chance to step into the world of Reformation Scotland and hear how singing touched everyone. The exhibition has wall paintings, miniatures and needlework to complement the songs, but I've come to hear about the most important surviving source for Scotland's early music, the St Andrew's Psalter, compiled by one Thomas Wood in the second half of the 16th century. To go with the exhibition, there's a compelling new CD recording of music from the Psalter, performed by the Dunedin Consort with fretwork and lutenist David Miller, and tracks from that CD will be our music for today's programme. Here's the anonymous round to Love the Lord, sung with a decidedly Scottish accent.
To serve the Lord and seek the Lord is a most worthy thing. To serve the Lord and seek the Lord is a most worthy thing. To serve the Lord and seek the Lord is a most worthy thing. To serve the Lord and seek the Lord is a most worthy thing.
Well, I've come into the exhibition room now and reluctantly resisting the temptation to rush round and look at everything because it is really full of delicious miniatures. I'm standing at the beginning with Dr. Noel O'Regan, who is senior lecturer in music at Edinburgh University, and he's a co-curator of this wonderful investigation. Noel, first question, who was Wood?
Thomas Wood started life as a Benedictine monk in the Abbey of Lindores, which is on the north coast of Fife. And then at the Reformation, clearly the abbey was destroyed, lost his position there, and became a reader in the new Reformed Scottish Church. He moved to St Andrews and continued under the patronage of Lord James Stuart, the Earl of Murray, who commissioned the part books which formed the basis of the exhibition.
And how did the Psalter come into being?
The Psalter was commissioned by Lord James Stuart, who was the half-brother of Mary Queen of Scots and was to succeed her as Regent of Scotland after she fled to England in 1567. Lord James was the leader of the Reformation Party, of the Lords of Congregation, very much in favour of the Reformation, but clearly a musical man like his father, King James V, somebody who wanted to see music continue in the Reformed Church. And so his commission to Wood was to obtain harmonisations of the 104 tunes which formed part of the new Scottish Psalter in 1564. Wood's job was to persuade and cajole the most famous composer in Scotland at the time, David Peebles, to produce harmonisations of these psalms.
In freedom I have fenced it in.
It's beginning to sound to me that Thomas Wood is very, very well worth marking with this exhibition. What were you hoping to do when you devised it?
The principal purpose was to bring back to Scotland for the first time since the 17th century the 8 surviving part books that were copied by Thomas Wood. Part books were the main method by which singers performed and instrumentalists performed in the 16th century. So you had one part book for each voice part, so soprano, alto, tenor and bass, and then you had a fifth part book for the extra parts for five voice music, six voice music, where extra parts were copied in.
It is fascinating. I've sung from part books a little, and I know there are ensembles who like to work that way all the time. But, I mean, nowadays, you sing 16th century music in ensemble and you're looking at a score. So if you think you might have gone wrong when you're sight reading through it, you can refer to other people's... Oh yes, I see, the tenor's going to come in here. So, and you do that little calculation. I mean, that's one of the purposes of having a score. And then there's the pleasure of seeing it all laid out. And I find it really fascinating to think of 16th century singers not having a clue, because they're just looking at their own part.
Absolutely, yes. And it probably means that they didn't rehearse in the way that we do, because you couldn't say, let's go from letter A or let's go from bar 45. You simply had to start all over again.
Would these part books have been used by singers in the church, or were they intended for domestic use?
That's a very good question, and I'm afraid there's no easy answer to that question. Probably they were designed perhaps for use in the Chapel Royal, where there were still very experienced singers, which was based in Stirling, but of course moved around with the monarch to Edinburgh, to Stirling, wherever the monarch might be.
Well, you've talked about the Scottish Chapel Royal moving about. Where do you want us to move to next in the exhibition?
I think if we go to the one of the cases where we show you the part books, five of the part books are currently in Edinburgh University Library. The other three have come back to us, one from Washington, from Georgetown University Library, one from the British Library, and one from Trinity College Dublin Library. So here we have three of the part books, for instance. This is the one from Trinity College Dublin, and here we have one from Washington, and then one from Edinburgh. And you can see, I think, immediately from this opening, which is Psalm 137, when as we sat in Babylon, the famous psalm about the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, because it speaks of the Jews hanging up their instruments on the willow trees, Wood took the opportunity to draw very carefully depictions of various instruments. You've got the harps, of course, you've got lutes, and you've got wind instruments.
And a tabor.
A tabor, yes, indeed.
Trumpets.
Yes, and trumpets and cittern, yes, a complete collection. They may not be realistic depictions of instruments, but and they're probably taken from illustrations of the time, from the sort of thing that Praetorius was showing in his Syntagma Musicum. But they clearly give us some sense of the instruments that were used in Scotland.
Instantly, I'm aware of the most tremendous paradox, because with the Reformation, particularly as it pertains to Scotland, the singing of religious music has been stripped back to basics. Everything is metrical, everything is isosyllabic. Like modern hymns, there is no decoration, no Catholic ornament of the worship of the Lord. And it's set down very plainly and very clearly, very legibly, although it's a little bit faded. And then all round it, there's this wonderful doodling, quite Baroque, really, in its extravagance. So obviously the love of ornament still prevails.
Absolutely, yes. I think you've put your finger on the whole crux of what happened to music in the period in the 1560s, when the Scottish Reformation, which came very suddenly in the end and had a very strong effect. Altars were broken up, music books, of course, were destroyed. We have very little that survives, and these books are among the little that do survive.
So just to recap, the part books were commissioned to provide harmonisations for the newly compiled Scottish Psalter of 1564, possibly intended for the Scottish Chapel Royal. But why was this new Psalter so important? Well, the Reformation hit Scotland in 1560, and its three key elements were the approval of a Protestant confession of faith, repudiation of papal authority, and the banning of the Mass. This is transforming stuff, not just for the life of the church, but for the intellectual and cultural climate of Scotland. The University of Edinburgh, location of today's early music show, has its roots embedded in this exciting, challenging new environment. Musically speaking, one of the key features of this new Psalter was the provision of plain metrical settings of the Psalms that could be understood and enjoyed by every member of the congregation. So there's the brief, but Thomas Wood was more ambitious.
Thomas Wood was afraid that music would perish in this land all utterly, as he actually writes in one of the part books. He clearly saw his mission not just as commissioning the psalm harmonizations from David Peebles, but also to include settings of hymns and canticles from the English prayer book liturgy, perhaps with the intention that these might find use in the new Scottish Reform liturgy, perhaps in this case also being encouraged by Lord James Stuart to provide these settings with the hope that the Scottish liturgy would include some good music. But much more than that, Wood, worrying that music was going to disappear from Scotland completely, took it on himself also to collect the music of his time, the music of his youth, music by various Scottish and continental composers. So he provides us with a fascinating insight into the music that was being sung and played on instruments in late 16th century Scotland.
Music by Lassus. Well, we've heard from a Scottish composer and a continental composer, but I noticed to my great satisfaction, Noel, that here we are standing in front of music by Thomas Tallis from Wood's part books. Not a psalm setting, I think. I'm sure you'll know better than I. This is "When Shall My Sorrowful Sighing Slake?" So it's another penitential text.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting. It's a secular piece, but the text, as you point out, is very much could be interpreted from a religious point of view. And we get a number of pieces like this in the Wood part books, setting texts which relate perhaps to Psalm 137, the Babylonian exile, ideas of abandonment, of captivity, which of course could have been applied in Scotland both to the Catholics and to the Protestants. So in a sense, they would bridge the religious divide.
And what does this collection really tell us about what music was being performed, how it was being played? I mean, there's room for a lot of polyphony, which surely goes a little bit against the stark simplicity that the Reformation was supposed to be aiming for. It's a little bit decadent, some of this stuff.
Decadent might be going a bit too far, but you're quite right. It's art music. I think what's interesting about the Calvin version of the Reformation is that in liturgy it was very strict, and really Calvin wanted just monophonic settings of metrical psalms. But it doesn't mean that you can't have good music in the house. And so essentially what we're looking at here is devotional music, or the music that was being performed in the great houses of Scotland, music by the continental composers. What it shows us, I think, is that Scotland was, you know, by no means isolated in this period. And to me, that's one of the most important contributions that these Thomas Wood Part books give to Scottish musical history. There's music by Palestrina, music by Clemens non Papa, Italian madrigals, French chanson, English music, instrumental music. There's a whole range of music there, which we know clearly because it was copied, was being performed, was being sung and played in Scottish houses.
Thank you.
I have to say, before we move on, it's leaving me a little bit confused about what to call this collection. It's the Wood Psalter, the St. Andrew's Psalter, the Wood Part books. So is there a single title that you could give this wonderful stuff?
I don't think there is, and it's interesting, in the course of the research surrounding this exhibition, we ourselves have wondered what to call them. They're traditionally called the St. Andrew's Psalter, because clearly they were copied in St. Andrew's, and they started life as settings of the new metrical Psalter. But because Wood expanded his ideas and what he did with these part books, they become, in a sense, a sort of commonplace book. They become a set of part books for singing, for playing. And so I prefer to myself to call them the Wood part books. One could also refer to them as the Wood Psalter. On the recording, we've called them the Wood Collection. The idea that Wood was a collector as well as a scribe, and so brought together the music that he had in his house, but also the music that he was getting from his friends and from other musicians in Scotland.
No, let's get back to Scots composers. And there are three names that we haven't mentioned so far. And their music gives us a little bit of an insight into instrumental playing at the time.
Yes, indeed. We have John Feddy, for instance, who was Wood, in fact, tells us one of the things about the part books that Thomas Wood did was to put little annotations in. So he doesn't just tell us who the composer was. He tells us that John Feddy came back to Scotland probably in the 1530s, 1540s, and that he introduced new keyboard fingering to Scotland, which is a very important annotation, gives us important information about the transmission of musical styles, instrumental performing styles from the continent to Scotland. We also have Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson is a fascinating character. We know very little actually about him, except that Wood tells us that he was banished or he fled from Scotland because he was accused of heresy well before the Reformation, so that could be in the 1520s, 1530s. He fled to England, and from what we know, he may have been a petty canon at Windsor. He seems to have been quite close to Henry VIII and to Anne Boleyn. He set a secular piece to words written by Anne Boleyn. And then finally, we have John Angus, who was clearly a good friend of Wood. He's the only composer that Wood actually calls Meek John Angus, Good John Angus, or Good and Meek John Angus. John Angus is another important character who was a monk in Dunfermline Abbey, Benedictine monk, before the Reformation. And then after the Reformation, continued as a Protestant clergyman, became a canon of the Chapel Royal in Stirling, would have taught music in the Song School in Dunfermline, and was commissioned essentially by Wood to set the canticles, so the Magnificat, the Nunc Dimittis, one assumes for use in the new Scottish liturgy.
Oh,
You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Catherine Bott, and today I'm visiting Edinburgh to investigate a gorgeous exhibition centred on the 16th century monk and scholar Thomas Wood and the good that he did for Scottish music. My guide is Dr. Noel O'Regan of Edinburgh University. Well, now for a very enjoyable moment. Dr. Noel O'Regan has put on the statutory white gloves. I have put down my pen, and we are actually, he is holding one of the part books of Thomas Wood, and opened at the most beautiful page with a man playing some kind of woodwind instrument, holding it in his right hand and casually holding a large piece of music in his left, which is a good moment to make the point that these books are not huge things that you often see in medieval pictures of lots of people clustered round big manuscripts on a stand. They are, each volume, about the size of an e-book reader. They're very, very portable and handy to hold, and a great treat, I would imagine, to just thumb through the pages, Noel.
Absolutely, yes, it's a privilege to be able to see these in the flesh, as it were. What we have here is the tenor part book, which is the part book, of course, which has the church part, the people's part of the Psalms. The harmonizations were done above and below the tenor part. We have, as you said, the illustration of a tenor who's actually playing probably some sort of shawm. It has been suggested that this might be a portrait of Thomas Wood. We also find in one of the soprano part books a little pen drawing of a scribe writing into the book, who might also, of course, represent Thomas Wood. So what we have here, the first 50, 60 or so pages is the Psalter. So we have each of the Psalms in turn, the tenor parts of the Psalms. And then as we leaf through, we go into the Canticles. The symbol of the Creed of Athanasius, for instance, which comes under the heading of a canticle. We have the Ten Commandments. And then we move into Wood's own collection. So we have music by continental composers. I have here an opening of the Osanna of an Italian Mass, or Mess. It's actually a Mass by Palestrina, not something you'd expect to find in a set of part books that started life as a Psalter. It's from the first book of Masses of Palestrina, the Missa Virtute Magna, and it's part of the Hosanna from the Benedictus, but clearly here set for instruments. It's not clear whether Wood even knew that it was by Palestrina or who Palestrina was. Of course, Palestrina was the papal composer, and this music was dedicated to Pope Julius III.
Suddenly you've moved on a few pages, and suddenly the notes are much, much smaller.
Yes, so this is the last stage of the part books after Wood died in 1592. So what we have here is a later scribe essentially using the blank pages. And so it's written in mainly Scottish songs, English songs, lute songs. And then at the end we have the common psalm tunes, very interestingly. As time went on, the number of psalm tunes reduced and reduced until at one point it was down to 12. So here we have, at the end of the part book, psalm tunes like Dundee, which you may know from the hymn books, Dunfermline. These common tunes, martyrs, the tunes which were used by the Scottish, the Church of Scotland, and indeed are still in use by the Church of Scotland.
And suddenly there are no illustrations, no illuminated capitals, no lovely doodles of keyboard instruments in the corners. This is a century of religious history in one book, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because it's coming from a tradition that's before the Reformation, and we end with an early sort of 17th century.
Yes, that's a very nice way of putting it, because you start, it could be a medieval book of ours. You have illuminated capitals at the start of each of the Psalms. It's the tradition in which Thomas Wood was brought up in Lindores Abbey as a scribe. And by the end, yes, you have the very plain martyr's tune with no decoration, as indeed it was intended to be sung.
Emmanuel, then spake Archangel Gabriel. heaven's king. We'll come, ye heaven's king. Here come a ship, fair sailing, and St. Michael was the steerest man. St. John sat in the horn. Your lord had bid your lady sang, and all the bells o' him they rang on Christ Sunday at morn. On Christ Sunday at morn, then sang the angels one song. Lord of Jerusalem, Domino, Lord of Deum Deum, Sion. The sons of Adam answered him, Saint Lord, became the good and man, the Father and the Spirit also. We honor and perpetual Jove, we honor and perpetual Jove.
I've sung one or two of the numbers on this lovely Dunedin Consort disc myself, and I'm thinking of the song O Lusty May. You read the words of O Lusty May, and it's clear that they are, it's Scottish English, Scots. It's not Gaelic, but it is very clearly not London-centric. I really enjoy the way the members of the Dunedin Consort have tackled this. What is the evidence when you're in another language, when you're in Latin, say, how do you sing it in 16th century Scots Latin?
It's a good question. If we take the Latin, there will be some evidence from particularly the influence of French pronunciation. So what we tend to do in Scotland is to use a sort of French Latin, if you like, because we're sort of assuming that because of the Auld Alliance and the French influence here, that Latin was pronounced perhaps in that sort of way. When it comes to the Psalms, it's interesting the Psalm translations themselves are in English, but we assume that when Scots sang them, they didn't sing in English, as certainly not in modern English. So what we've tried to do there is to sing them as Scots might have sung them, Scots who generally spoke Scots in the 16th century. The songs like O Lusty May or Lusty May, as you've just mentioned, they're certainly in Scots, and so we can use contemporary evidence for Scottish pronunciation, for the pronunciation of Scots. We've relied a lot on Dr. Jamie Reid Baxter, who has spent quite a long time studying this, and of course Susan Hamilton, who is the leader of the Dunedin Consort, is herself Scottish, and again has a good tradition of singing in Scots.
Fresh water.
No, I'm very drawn to the most ravishing portrait shown here in reproduction, an anonymous portrait of a beautifully attired and fiercely intelligent-looking lady, Esther Inglis. She is wearing an astonishing hat, some fairly astonishing sleeves, some wonderful crewel work embroidery on her breast, jewels at her throat, and an enormous ruff. Who was she?
You've picked out one of the most beautiful paintings in the exhibition, reproductions of paintings in the exhibition. Esther Inglis actually is something of a counterpart to Thomas Wood, and that's why we have her here. She was a French lady from a French family who fled after the St. Bartholomew Day massacre in 1572, came to England and then came to Scotland. And she was a miniaturist. And you can see here a reproduction of one of her psalm books. So exactly the same in a way as what Thomas Wood was doing. This is the Psalms of David in French. And she has the same annotations, illustrations in the borders. We also, to give some context to Thomas Wood and his illustrations, we have a sampler here of stitching based on some of the images from Wood. So you can see the sun and the moon here from illustrating one of the Psalms talking about the heavens and the firmaments. So we've got the sun and the moon here. We also have a cushion, which uses one of the initial letters from Thomas Wood, one of his O's, which we think was probably based on a flower. And so it's the top-down view, if you like, of a flower. Thomas Wood, of course, is coming from a tradition of medieval illustrations, but he's also relying on the books of his time, the herbals. He uses a lot of thistles being the symbol, of course, of the Stuart monarchy and the symbol of Scotland later on. So we get all sorts of birds, we get plants, we get musical instruments, as we've seen. So it's a complete, again, history of Scottish illustration, relating, for instance, to the ceiling of Crotus Castle on Dee Side, which is famous.
Shows ladies playing various lutes and keyboards and a viola da gamba. This is a lovely wall, the end wall of the exhibition, putting the music into context and making the very good point that music didn't exist in a vacuum. I have found a sentence that I just have to quote by this cushion, which is always very important to remember when you're listening to early music and sitting on a comfy sofa. Household seating was not upholstered, so as well as being decorative, cushions of all sizes and shapes were a necessity. Early music is the most wonderful, comforting stuff, but it was not written in a time of plump sofas. I never want to forget that. Helps your interpretations.
Like as the damsel sick we awake it would come to sorrow on the sun is good or sicht. He's done his he that droops as did and will no spread, but logs as leaf through iron all the nicht. Till foolish faith and rise we weapon on, till clear the crystal skies on licht the lawn. Words in their poor looks for a door and to the prince and
What became of Thomas Wood?
Slightly sad. Thomas Wood, he lived on in St. Andrews until 1592, but in 1592 he was mugged, essentially. There's a record of this in the court proceedings in St. Andrews. He was going home one night, an old man, and somebody knocked his stick. And so he shouted, "Murder, murder, I'm being attacked." Somebody from St. Andrews was charged with the murder, with the attempted murder, and was put into the stocks and then banished. It's not quite clear whether it was, might have had a political or some sort of motivation, because it was done by somebody that knew Wood and who Wood knew. But sadly, a few months later he died, and it's quite likely that the effect of the mugging probably hastened his death. The part books themselves, we really don't know much about what happened to them after Wood's death. They may have gone to Aberdeen for some time. A lot of music was copied in by later scribes, music which corresponds to the publication by John Forbes in Aberdeen in the 1660s, for instance. They then went to Ireland, because one of the part books is still in Trinity College, and we know that some of the others were also in Ireland in the 17th century. And then they disappear for a while and then resurface in the four libraries where we find them today.
And here they are, reunited in one room.
Absolutely, for the first time, and perhaps the last time, at least in our lifetime. It's been quite a lot of work to organise, as you can imagine, the bringing back of these part books. So it's a very special occasion for us in Scotland.
Well, I think we should end. Well, I should end by thanking you for being my eloquent guide around this fascinating exhibition. It's one room, but so crammed with beauty. But I think we should end with Robert Johnson, Scottish composer, his setting of Psalm 67. And the text for this is, "Lord, bless and pity us, shine on us with thy face, that the earth thy way and nations all may know thy saving grace."
Deus miserere.
Robert Johnson's setting of Psalm 67, Deus Miserator Nostri, performed by the Dunedin Consort. It's a piece that appears in the series of part books known as the Wood Collection or the St Andrew's Psalter, which was the subject of today's early music show presented by Catherine Bott. The producer was Chris Wines. And the exhibition Singing the Reformation, celebrating the bringing together of the eight part books of the Wood Collection to their native Scotland for the first time in modern history. The exhibition can be found in the Library of Edinburgh University on George Square until October the 28th. Tomorrow's early music show explores the musical legacy of King Dinis of Portugal. That's just after the 1 o'clock news tomorrow lunchtime here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget the weekly early music show podcast. Full details on the Radio 3 website.
I would give anything. Anything.
Through unimaginable challenge, an unwavering belief.
A vision!
Follow him!
Hooray!
New writing.
The death penalty is a self-defensive right of the state.
And classic drama.
Christ in heaven. She did come from God.
On BBC Radio 3. Conviction. A new sequence of dramas in The Wire on Saturday nights and Drama on 3 on Sundays.
As long as I am here, you are with me.
With seven scenes in The Wire.
I think of you and what it means to be your mother.
Tonight at 9:40 on BBC Radio 3.
And before it, with tonight's opera on 3, Debussy's masterpiece Pelléas et Mélisande, set in a kind of mythical no-man's land about a woman's love for her husband's brother and her eventual death of a broken heart. It's a concert performance recorded in May this year at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris, with baritone Simon Keenlyside as Pelléas, one of his most celebrated roles, soprano Nathalie Dessay as Mélisande, and baritone Laurent Nauri as her husband Golo. Louis Langres conducts the Paris Orchestra and Chorus, and that's Opera on 3, Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande, here on BBC Radio 3, setting off at 6 o'clock this evening. It's now 2 minutes past two, and a second chance to hear the Radio 3 lunchtime concert recorded last Monday at Wigmore Hall in London. The presenter is Susie Klein.
Hello. Today we have a recital from a 28-year-old tenor from Hertfordshire who describes himself rather charmingly as a bit of a nerd when it comes to singing. He's one of the current crop of Radio 3 new generation artists trained at the Royal College of Music, winner of the 2008 Kathleen Ferrier Prize. Here's Ben Johnson, joined today by another great young performer, the pianist James Baillieu, to perform Schubert's last great collection of songs, Schwanengesang. It's a series of 14 songs on love and loss, longing and wandering, one of the high watermarks of the tenor repertoire. Earlier today, Ben Johnson told me that for him, the key to getting a performance of this right is just to follow the page. He said, it's incredibly detailed. Schubert's very specific in the score. Every marking is there. The emotion he wrings out of the text is just amazing. So, here to perform Schubert's Schwanengesang at Wigmore Hall, it's the tenor, Ben Johnson, the pianist, James Baillieu.
Fläschlein, mein Bruder, sei du. Bringe die Grüße des Fernen ihr zu. All ihre Blumen im Garten gepflegt, die sie so lieblich am Busen trägt, und ihre Rosen in purpurne Glut, Bächleine Kieke mit kühlende Flut, und ihre Rosen in purpurne Glut, Bächleine Kieke mit kühlende Flut. Wenn sie am Ufer in Träume versenkt, meine Gedenken das Köpfchen hängt, tröste die Süße mit freundlichem Blick, denn der Geliebte kehrt bald zurück. Tröste die Süße mit freundlichem Blick, denn der Geliebte kehrt bald zurück. Neigt sich die Sonne mit rötlichem Schein, wiege das Liebchen im Schlummer ein, rausche sie wulmend in süßer Ruhe,
Herz, dass den Frust dich nicht verlässt, dass den Frust dich nicht verlässt, es ruft noch manche Schlacht. Bald ruhig wohl und schlafe fest, et liebste gute Nacht, et liebste gute Nacht. Jetzt, dass ein Trost dich nicht verlässt, dass ein Trost dich nicht verlässt,